I want you to imagine, just for a second, sitting in this sterile, brightly lit doctor's office.
Right, the classic clinical setting.
Exactly. And you've been having some memory issues. Things are just kind of slipping. And the doctor sits down and hands you a devastating early stage Alzheimer's diagnosis.
Which is just an unimaginable weight.
It really is. I mean, this is a disease that currently affects, what, 6.7 million Americans?
About that.
And right now, there's absolutely no cure to reverse it. But then imagine that same doctor leans in and suggests an experimental treatment. And this treatment is designed not just to ease that crushing anxiety of the diagnosis, but to potentially, literally rewire your deteriorating brain.
In the cellular level, yeah.
Right. But the catch, the treatment is a massive clinical dose of psilocybin.
The active ingredient in magic mushrooms.
Exactly.
I mean, it sounds like some counterculture fever dream, right? Just masquerading as medicine.
Totally.
But the biological reality we're looking at today is incredibly grounded. And frankly, it's challenging all the foundational assumptions of how we even treat neurodegeneration.
Well, welcome to today's deep dive. We've custom tailored this for you, the listener, who wants to cut through all the cultural noise, skip the basic textbook definitions, and really understand the hard science behind a radical new frontier in brain health.
Yes.
Today, we are synthesizing two phenomenal sources. First, we've got an interview transcript from the GW Integrative Medicine Show featuring a leading researcher at Johns Hopkins,
Dr. Albert Garcia Romeo.
Right. And we are pairing that with this deeply technical neuroscience article from the OOTW Journal titled Psilocybin and Alzheimer's Disease, the Neuroplasticity Hypothesis.
So our mission today is to unpack exactly how a classic psychedelic might biologically counteract the specific destructive mechanisms of Alzheimer's.
Separating the hype from the reality.
Exactly. We want to know the biochemical reality of what happens when these compounds enter an aging brain.
Okay, so let's unpack this. Because before we can understand the cellular magic trick of, you know, how this works, we really need to understand the human story of why researchers even thought to test psychedelics on memory loss in the first place.
Right, because it's a massive leap.
Yeah, from recreation to Alzheimer's research.
Well, the origin story actually starts in a completely different wing of the hospital, which is end-of-life palliative care.
Oh, wow, really?
Yeah. So for years, the team at Johns Hopkins has been studying these classic psychedelics. And pharmacologically speaking, these are serotonin 2A receptor agonists.
Found in, like, over 200 species of fungi naturally, right?
Exactly. So initially, the Hopkins team was administering high doses of psilocybin to cancer patients who were facing terminal diagnoses.
Because the psychological weight of a terminal cancer diagnosis, I mean, that brings an unimaginable level of existential dread.
It does. And the results from those Hopkins studies were just staggering, with just one or two high doses.
Wait, just one or two?
Yeah, just one or two. Accompanied by rigorous psychological support, of course, before, during, and after the session.
Right. You're not just handing them a pill and leaving.
No, not at all. But these patients experienced drastic reductions in anxiety, depression, and end-of-life distress.
That's incredible.
And those improvements in their quality of life, they didn't just fade away after the drug wore off in a few hours. The psychological relief lasted for like 6 to 9 months.
Wow. And so that sustained relief, that's what sparked this whole new connection for Alzheimer's.
Exactly. Dr. Garcia Romeo was talking with a colleague who works in geriatric neuropsychiatry. And this colleague pointed out that receiving an Alzheimer's diagnosis or even mild cognitive impairment, it carries a very specific, profound trauma.
Well, yeah, you're being told you're going to slowly lose your memories.
Your independence.
Your sense of self. It's basically a psychological death sentence that precedes the physical one.
Which naturally leads to the big question. If psilocybin helps cancer patients cope with the trauma of a terminal physical illness, why not use it to treat the specific psychological trauma of cognitive decline?
So that was the catalyst for the ongoing pilot study at Hopkins.
Yes. The primary focus there has been on mood and quality of life for early stage Alzheimer's patients. They really just want to see if that existential dread can be lifted.
But they added something else, didn't they?
They did. They added this exploratory aim to the trial that kind of took it from a psychological study to a neurological one. They started testing memory and cognitive tasks to see if the drug does more than just boost mood.
It's kind of like finding a hidden underlying feature on your smartphone, like you download an app to help you sleep.
Right.
Which in this case is the psychological support easing the anxiety.
Right.
But while the app is running, you suddenly realize it's also silently optimizing your battery life and rewriting the core code to make the hardware run smoother?
That's a great way to put it. The brain structure itself might actually be changing while the patient is experiencing this profound shift in mood.
But wait,
yeah.
I have to push back here. Managing anxiety about memory loss is one thing, but halting the physical cognitive decline, that is an entirely different universe of medicine.
It is.
So are we just giving people psychedelics to make them feel better about losing their memory? Or is there actual hard biological evidence that it interrupts the disease process itself?
Well, to answer that, we have to zoom in from the psychologist's couch all the way down to the cellular level.
Okay, let's do it.
Alzheimer's is driven by very specific physical destructions in the brain. And the sources outline how psilocybin seems to interrupt those exact processes.
Right.
The first major structural failure is the collapse of something called a BDNF.
Okay, brain-derived neurotrophic factor. I know this is a huge buzzword in longevity spaces, but what is it actually doing in the brain on, like, a random Tuesday afternoon?
Think of BDNF as the most important fertilizer in the adult brain.
Fertilizer.
Yeah, it's a neurotrophin. It governs synaptic growth. It drives the cellular process behind memory consolidation. And it physically keeps the neurons in your hippocampus alive and communicating.
And the hippocampus, that's basically the brain's inbox for new memories.
Exactly.
It is also the very first structure reliably damaged in Alzheimer's. So when the disease sets in, the BDNF levels must be taking a massive hit.
Oh, they drop off a cliff.
Yeah.
Postmortem studies show that hippocampal BDNF levels are 30 to 40% lower in Alzheimer's patients compared to healthy brains of the same age.
30 to 40%. That's huge.
It is. The neurons are essentially starving for trophic support. And that drop, it isn't just a symptom. It actually precedes and predicts the clinical cognitive deterioration.
So the brain basically loses its ability to feed its own memory centers.
Exactly.
But if the brain stops producing the fertilizer, the plants die. So how does psilocybin fix a starving neuron if the body has literally stopped making BDNF?
By acting as a psychoplastogen.
A psycho what?
Psychoplastogen. It's a term coined by a lab at UC Davis to describe compounds that rapidly promote structural and functional neuroplasticity.
Okay, got it.
So psilocybin directly activates these things called TRKB receptors on the neurons. And those are the exact same receptors that BDNF normally binds to.
Oh, so it bypasses the missing BDNF entirely.
Yes. It hits the receptor and triggers synaptic growth within hours. And that growth persists for weeks after the drug is gone from the system.
Okay, let's visualize this. Say building memories is like building a bridge, right?
Okay.
And BDNF is the supply truck burning the steel and concrete to the construction site.
Mm.
But Alzheimer's disease destroys the roads, so the supply trucks can't get through.
Right.
The bridge starts to collapse because the workers have no materials. But then psilocybin comes in like a fleet of helicopters, airdropping the supplies directly onto the construction site.
Which is the TRKB receptor.
Right. Completely bypassing the broken roads. It forces the building to continue even when the local infrastructure has failed.
That helicopter bypass is vital because the environment surrounding those neurons has become deeply toxic.
Toxic how?
Well, Alzheimer's is no longer viewed by researchers as just a disease of plaques and tangles. It is fundamentally recognized as an inflammatory disease. The brain's immune system basically turns on itself.
Which brings us to the second major issue. Psilocybin addresses, right? Neuroinflammation.
Yes.
And this ties directly into psilocybin's primary target, the 5-HT2A receptors.
Exactly. So the 5-HT2A receptor is highly concentrated on cortical pyramidal neurons.
The glutamatergic neurons, the communication backbone of your cortex.
You got it. And they are the primary victims of Alzheimer's. Postmortem research reveals that in the Alzheimer's cortex, these 5-HT2A receptors are just eradicated, reduced by up to 40%.
So the disease destroys the exact receptor that psilocybin needs to bind to in order to work.
Right. The target is shrinking.
So what happens when psilocybin binds to the surviving receptors, the ones that are left?
It triggers a profound anti-inflammatory response. It does this by suppressing a master transcription factor called NF-kappa-B.
NF-kappa-B. I mean, that sounds like alphabet soup. What is its day job in the brain?
It acts like a master alarm bell for the immune system.
Okay.
When microglia, those are the immune cells of the brain, when they become activated in Alzheimer's, NF-kappa-B tells them to start pumping out inflammatory cytokines.
And cytokines are those chemical distress signals, right?
Yes. They cause the immune system to attack surrounding tissue. It's friendly fire.
Oh, wow.
So by suppressing NF-kappa-B, psilocybin shuts down the production of those distress signals. It essentially muffles the alarm bell and cools the fire, acting as this really potent centralized anti-inflammatory agent right at the site of the damage.
Okay, so we've airdropped supplies to build new synaptic connections, and we've muffled the chemical alarm bells to stop the friendly fire from the immune system.
Right.
But Alzheimer's leaves behind actual physical garbage in the brain, right? The plaques and the tangles.
It does.
Does bypassing the broken roads and stopping the fire do anything about the physical roadblocks that are already strangling the neurons?
So that structural debris is the most notoriously difficult part of Alzheimer's to treat. And this brings us to tau phosphorylation.
Okay, so from what I understand about tau proteins, they act like the physical scaffolding of a building. They hold the neuron's internal supply lines, the microtubules, open so nutrients can travel up and down the cell. Is that right?
That is exactly right. When tau is functioning normally, it keeps everything stable. But in Alzheimer's, an enzyme called GSK3-beta goes into overdrive.
Oh, no.
Yeah. It hyperphosphorylates the tau.
So it essentially chemically modifies the scaffolding so much that it just breaks under its own weight.
Yeah, it adds too many chemical tags. So the tau detaches from the microtubules, it misfolds, and it aggregates into these neurofibrillary tangles.
And those tangles literally choke the neurons from within.
They do. It is a cardinal hallmark of the disease pathology.
And this is where that 2023 study in Cell Reports Medicine becomes so critical, right? The one by Calder and Bhattacharya.
Yes, exactly. Now, they didn't test this in humans. They used mice.
Specifically, 3XTG80 mice, which is this highly validated transgenic mouse model genetically engineered to express three different human Alzheimer's mutations.
Exactly. So the researchers gave these mice a single dose of psilocybin.
Just one.
Just one single dose. And when they examined the brains 4 weeks later, they found a massive reduction in tau phosphorylation.
Wow.
Specifically at the AT8 and AT180 sites, which are the critical markers that clinical researchers track.
And how big was the reduction?
The reduction was approximately 35%.
35% from a single dose. I mean, that is a massive anomaly in neuropharmacology. How is a single exposure creating that kind of structural change to a tangled protein weeks later?
It traces back to that initial chain reaction at the receptor. Psilocybin activates the TRKB receptor, which triggers a downstream signaling pathway inside the cell called ACT. And that ACT pathway serves as an inhibitor for that bad enzyme, GSK3-beta.
Oh.
Right. By inhibiting that specific enzyme, psilocybin essentially takes the chemical weight off the tau protein. It stops the enzyme from over-tightening the screws, allowing the tau to remain stable rather than clumping together.
It literally turns off the factory that makes the tangles.
Exactly.
When you lay out the biochemistry like that, it's elegant.
Mm-hmm.
But there's another mechanism outlined in our sources, and it shifts us from the microscopic chemistry back to the macroscopic experience of the patient.
The default mode network.
Yes, the default mode network.
Also known as the DMN. It bridges the gap between cellular health and subjective consciousness. It's the neural network responsible for our mind wandering, our autobiographical memory retrieval, our daydreaming.
It's the neurological basis of that chattering, ruminating self you hear in your head when you aren't focused on a specific task.
Right. Think about the last time you were just staring out a window and your brain was endlessly chatting with itself about a conversation you had yesterday or worrying about tomorrow.
Yeah, that happens all the time.
That is your default mode network running. Now imagine if you couldn't turn that chatter off.
That sounds exhausting.
Because in early Alzheimer's, something paradoxical happens. You'd think a dying brain is slowing down, but the DMN actually hyperactivates.
Wait, it speeds up.
Yeah. In a healthy brain, the DMN suppresses itself the moment you need to focus on a math problem or navigate a new street. But in early Alzheimer's, it fails to suppress.
It just gets stuck.
It stays locked in a state of relentless hyperactivity. The posterior cingulate cortex, which serves as the metabolic hub of the DMN, starts burning an immense amount of energy.
And researchers suspect that this relentless firing is literally exhausting the brain.
Exactly.
So it's like a symphony orchestra where the conductor has completely lost their sheet music and all the sections, the brass, the strings, the percussion, are just playing loudly over each other without ever pausing for rest.
And the exhaust from that endless playing has physical consequences. The hyperactive posterior cingulate cortex is exactly where amyloid plaques accumulate the earliest and the most densely.
Wow.
The metabolic overdrive seems to actually drive the deposition of the plaques.
Okay, so if an overactive default mode network is literally burning out the brain and driving toxic plaque buildup, is a psilocybin trip a essentially acting like a physical pause,
mm-hmm.
like taking the baton from the conductor, forcing the orchestra to stop, recalibrate, and wait for a new rhythm.
Yes.
Because psilocybin is famous for shutting down the DMN.
The fMRI data confirms that exact phenomenon. Every neuroimaging study to date shows that psilocybin acutely suppresses and desynchronizes the default mode network during the active session.
So it forces it to rest.
Doesn't just quiet down. It temporarily dissolves and reorganizes. It forms new transient connections across different areas of the brain that don't normally communicate.
That's fascinating.
It breaks the pathological cycle of hyperactivity, giving that exhausted network a literal hard reboot.
Okay, so let me get this straight. We're looking at a compound that reduces toxic brain tangles by 35%. It shuts down neuroinflammation, it bypasses broken brain chemistry to grow new synapses, and it hard reboots an exhausted neural network.
When you list it all out, yeah.
It sounds miraculous.
Yeah.
Which is exactly why I need to hit the brakes here and look at the real world.
Right, because moving from preclinical mechanisms to a local pharmacy is fraught with massive logistical and biological roadblocks.
Let's be real, it is remarkably easy to cure a mouse.
Very easy.
We have cured Alzheimer's in transgenic mice 1,000 times over the last few decades, and those same treatments consistently fail when they reach human trials.
Right.
Human brains are infinitely more complex, and mice don't naturally develop the full amyloid cascade the way we do. We cannot put the cart before the horse and assume a mushroom that untangles a mouse's brain will automatically save a human being's memories.
That translational gap from mouse to human is significant. But honestly, the more immediate roadblocks for psilocybin are logistical, and they're deeply tied to the nature of the drug itself.
Like the consent challenge.
Exactly. A classic psychedelic trial requires a massive 4 to 6 hour supervised trip. It is psychologically demanding. It often involves ego dissolution and processing deeply repressed emotions.
And as Alzheimer's progresses, patients literally lose their cognitive capacity to consent to something that intense.
Yes. They lose the ability to provide informed consent, and equally importantly, they may lack the psychological resilience to endure a deeply altered state of consciousness.
Because you cannot safely guide someone through the dissolution of their ego if they are already suffering from clinical confusion about who and where they are.
Exactly. This is why human research is heavily restricted to the prodromal stage mild cognitive impairment, where patients still have their decisional capacity and physical orientation completely intact.
There are also massive question marks around drug interactions. We have zero data on how a heroic dose of psilocybin interacts with the few Alzheimer's medications we already prescribe, like donepezil.
Right, because donepezil primarily modulates the cholinergic system to boost memory temporarily, but it also has downstream interactions with serotonergic systems.
So combining a heavy serotonergic agonist like psilocybin with donepezil, without rigorous multi-phase pharmacological safety trials that could risk dangerous side effects.
Definitely.
And we cannot ignore the bureaucratic and economic realities here. Psilocybin is still a Schedule I substance in the United States.
Which is a nightmare for research.
Right. Running a clinical trial with a Schedule I drug is an administrative nightmare. Dr. Garcia Romeo noted how incredibly difficult it is just to obtain the synthesized drug legally for research purposes.
And furthermore, because psilocybin is a naturally occurring compound that literally grows out of the ground, it is non-proprietary.
Oh, meaning pharma companies can't patent it.
Exactly. A pharmaceutical company cannot easily patent a mushroom that has existed in nature for thousands of years.
And without a strong patent, there is little financial incentive for massive pharmaceutical companies to invest the billions of dollars required to run sprawling phase 3 human trials.
Which forces researchers to look for alternatives to the 6-hour supervised trip. And this is where the concept of microdosing comes into the clinical conversation.
So taking a subperceptual dose, just enough of the drug to trigger the biological effect without inducing the psychedelic experience.
Right. If the psychoplastogenic affects the TRKB activation, the anti-inflammatory NF-kappa-B suppression, the tau untangling, if all of that can be triggered by a dose so low it doesn't cause a trip, it solves multiple bottlenecks at once.
It solves the consent issue for late-stage dementia patients.
Yes.
It solves the massive clinical logistics of paying two therapists to sit in a room for 6 hours.
Exactly. And you potentially create a daily neuroprotective regimen. But we have to be clear, the data on whether microdosing actually achieves these cellular changes in humans is still heavily debated and entirely untested in an Alzheimer's population.
So what does this all mean for you, the listener? Why should you care about transgenic mouse models, defaulting brain networks, and bureaucratic research hurdles?
Because the reality is stark.
Yeah. Alzheimer's is a $345 billion annual crisis in the U.S. alone. It is going to touch almost every family eventually.
And the current arsenal of drugs just aren't cutting it.
Not at all. The symptom managers that just buy a few months of clarity and the newly approved antibody treatments that come with narrow application windows and severe risks of brain bleeding, it's just not enough.
We are witnessing a potential monumental paradigm shift in neurobiology here. For decades, the focus has been on merely trying to clear away the debris of Alzheimer's after the damage is done. But psilocybin points toward a future of fostering neuroplastic resilience, strengthening the surviving networks, bypassing the broken systems, and forcing the brain to grow stronger amidst the pathology.
It is a completely different way to view the aging brain.
Mm-hmm.
And it leaves us with something profoundly philosophical to think about.
It really does.
I mean, we are discussing a compound that for thousands of years has been known entirely for radically altering our conscious, subjective, spiritual experience.
Yeah.
And yet, this exact same compound is revealing itself to be a highly specific biological tool that physically protects the cellular structure of the brain.
So it begs a lingering question for you to mull over.
Exactly. If a compound that induces a deeply subjective psychedelic trip is the exact same key that triggers physical cellular neuroprotection, does that mean our subjective consciousness and our cellular health are far more deeply intertwined than modern medicine has ever been willing to admit?
It forces us to ask if the health of the mind and the physical survival of the brain are inextricably linked through the exact same chemical pathways.
A completely new landscape for how we understand human memory. We'll leave you with that thought. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive.